I'm not going to go through a big long summary of what we've addressed so far, but suffice to say, if you want to listen to it, if you didn't hear it, go back. Oh, I heard crickets. That was weird. That was an actual cricket? I thought that was a sound effect. All right, so if you want to know what we've covered so far, you can go back, but basically, and listen on Podbean, but we have basically shown that God must exist through the way the universe is designed, the way our planet is designed, the way life is designed. And so if there is a God, what God is God? And that's where we're looking at the Bible and going through that, mainly the New Testament, because that's what Christianity hinges on. So last week, we talked about how some people believe that the New Testament Gospels and books were written way hundreds of years after Jesus, but that's not true. We've actually narrowed down some of them as early as 20 and 30 years after Jesus, which you have to understand, back then they didn't have a typewriter, they didn't have a computer, they didn't have, so, you know, writing these things down and having them circulated back then, it's a totally different process than it is now. So we've determined that the New Testament scripture is early. So now we're going to look at some of the content, okay? And so this week we're going to focus on eyewitness testimony about Jesus. Because again, when you're going back and looking at these things in history, you have to look at, okay, what was written? When was it written? What does it contain? Is there eyewitness testimony? Things like that, right? So here we go. Historical test number two, do the New Testament documents contain eyewitness testimony? Okay, now I'm going to, at the beginning here, this part, I'm just going to say yes, and there are a million examples, but I'm just going to read a couple of them. So Acts 2:32, written by Luke, God raised this Jesus to life, and we are all witnesses of that fact. Also in Acts, you killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead. We are witnesses of this. Then the rulers, elders, teachers of the law called them in again and commanded them not to speak or teach at all in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John replied, judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God, for we cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard. And this goes on and on and on and on, okay? If you want to read all these examples, get this book. The book is called, I don't even know what it's called anymore. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, okay? And it has all of these examples in here. Then when we talk about Paul, Paul specifically lists 14 people whose names are known as eyewitnesses of the resurrection, the 12 apostles, James, and himself, and he claims that there were more than 500 others. Matthew and Luke confirm the appearances to the apostles. All four Gospels mention the women as witnesses, with Mark identifying them as Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome. Luke adds Joanna, that's four more. Acts 1 also reveals that Barabbas was an eyewitness as well. So not only do they claim to be eyewitnesses, on several occasions they tell their audience that everyone knows what they're saying is true. These are not offhanded comments, but bold proclamations to powerful people. For example, at one point, Paul goes before King Agrippa, and as he's talking about what's going on, Festus, which is a governor, says, you are out of your mind, Paul. Your great learning is driving you insane. He said, I'm not insane. What I am saying is true and reasonable. The king is familiar with these things, and I can speak freely to him. I am convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do. So this isn't, it's not like this kind of sort of just happened in secret. And I mean, like, this is a widely known event at the time, right? And when you look at a lot of this, okay, so the risk that Paul and Peter and the other apostles took to claim that they were providing eyewitness testimony surely suggests that they were telling the truth. Because if these accounts are true, the apostles' unwavering testimony and provocative challenges demonstrate they were eyewitnesses who really believed Jesus rose from the dead. So they were facing political figures. They were facing the very powerful people that wanted to squash this, right? That wanted to persecute them. And yet in the face of that, they still maintained their eyewitness accounts, right? That's a huge part of credibility. So let's talk about Luke for a second. So suppose someone wrote a book in 1980 describing your hometown as in that year. In that book, the author correctly describes your town's politicians, its unique laws, penal codes, local industry, local weather patterns, local slang, town roads and geography, usual topography, local houses of worship, area hotels, town statues and sculptures, the depth of the water in the town harbor, and numerous other unique details about your town that year. Question: if the author claimed he had visited your town that year or said that he had gotten good information from people who had been there, would you think that he was telling the truth? Of course you would, because he has details only an eyewitness could provide. That's the type of testimony we have throughout much of the New Testament. Luke includes the most eyewitness details. So a classical scholar and historian, Colin Hemmer, goes through the book of Acts, verse by verse, and he identifies 84 facts in the last 16 chapters of Acts confirmed by historical and archaeological research. Now, I'm not going to read all of these. Again, if you want that, go here. But 84, I mean, just to give you an example, the proper port, Italia, which returning travelers would use, an altar to an unknown god, a Corinthian synagogue, well-known shrines and images of Artemis, the correct name to designate the goddess, danger of a coastal trip in this location, all kinds of stuff, whether it's location or whether it's people. There's no doubt that he was an eyewitness to all of this. So now this is where people that are skeptical, they get uncomfortable. So you've got all of these facts and all of these things that have been verified to be true. But then Luke reports a total of 35 miracles in that same book. And then they want to say, well, that's not true. So why would Luke go to all of the painstaking, get all the painstaking details right about everything else and then make that up? It just doesn't make sense. And so when you're looking at the credibility of a historian and you start breaking it down, you have to give him the benefit of the doubt that what he has written is true, unless you have direct evidence contrary to that, which we don't, right? So, let's see. All right, so let's look at some evidence. So first of all, we know that Luke and the Gospel of Luke and Acts are very closely related. We know that because they use the same Greek vocabulary, literary style, and he addresses both documents to most excellent Theophilus. Which is most likely a Roman official, because that's the same title Paul used to address the Roman governors Felix and Festus. So the main point is that Luke reveals Acts as a continuation of his gospel. In the opening, he says, "In my former book, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach till the day he was taken to heaven." And then he used Acts to tell what happened after Christ's ascension. So should we expect the same degree of accuracy from Luke's gospel? So in other words, we've talked about all of the facts and all the things in Acts. So if he was that accurate in Acts, should we expect the same for the gospel of Luke? And so in the gospel of Luke, there were another 59 of these historical facts that we go through and that prove that book is also historically accurate. So then again, why would Luke, again, do all of that, make all of those details accurate, and then lie about Jesus and everything else? It doesn't make sense, okay? Even in, he mentioned, In Luke 22:44, where Luke records Jesus was in agony and sweat drops of blood the night before his crucifixion, Jesus was experiencing a rare stress-induced condition we know today as hematohidrosis, when tiny blood vessels rupture due to extreme stress, allowing blood to mix with sweat. Luke didn't know of this medical condition 2,000 years ago. He would not have recorded it unless he had access to someone who saw it. In other words, it's not something he would have just made up, right? Okay, so now here's the critical point. If Luke is telling the truth, then so are Mark and Matthew, because their gospels tell the same basic story. Now let's talk about John for a second. Some people say that John is a later work, expresses invented deity of Christ theology, so it can't be trusted. But if the critics are wrong and John is accurate, then we have another independent witness to conclude the New Testament story is true. So how accurate is John? What does the evidence say? Well, John appears to be an eyewitness because he includes intimate details about numerous private conversations of Jesus, but there's much more evidence for that. They did a detailed study. Craig Blomberg did a detailed study of the Gospel of John, examined it verse by verse. John describes events confined to the Holy Land, so there aren't as many geographical, topographical, and political items as Acts. However, there are almost 60 additional details, historical details, that have been confirmed throughout that book. Mostly a lot of the names, a lot of the people, and just a lot of the ways of the time. And so is there a doubt with that John was an eyewitness or at least had access to eyewitness testimony? No. It would actually be harder to believe that he wasn't an eyewitness as opposed to him being one. So then they talk about right here is that we don't have the time and space to go through all of everything that's ever been verified, but there is plenty enough to establish its accuracy. Okay, so here's the other thing. So the New Testament writers put historical crosshairs into their accounts by referencing real historical figures and their doings. So, in other words, Matthew, for example, mentions independent confirmed historical figures such as Herod the Great, his three sons, also describes the man Herod Antipas killed, John the Baptist, along with the two women instigated the killing, Herodias and her daughter. Mark tells the same story about Herod Antipas and John the Baptist, and Luke extends it, the Herodian bloodline, by mentioning Herod the Great's grandson Agrippa, the king who killed James, John's brother, and his great-grandson Agrippa II, the king before whom Paul testified. Pilate is a prominent figure in all four Gospels and is cited by Paul. Pilate is also a prominent figure in all four Gospels. In addition to Pilate, the high priest Caiaphas, who sentenced Jesus to die, is also mentioned. And he is not only also mentioned by Josephus, but his bones were actually found in 1990. So basically, the point of what I've just said here is they've boxed themselves in. If they were telling a fantastical, fictional story, they have boxed themselves in by timing, the political figures and the leadership that were in place at the time of these stories, the traditions, the customs, the locations, the topography, everything. They have literally put themselves into a corner. And if any of that was wrong or was challenged, it would negate the entire thing. And it's not wrong. So now it says right here, and I think this is really good. So in spite of the 140-plus eyewitness details and 30-plus references to real people, a skeptic might say, but that doesn't mean the New Testament is true. Maybe it's a historical novel, fiction, set in real historical context, kind of like a Tom Clancy book. Well, there's a problem with that. First, it doesn't explain why independent non-Christian writers collectively reveal a storyline similar to the New Testament. If New Testament events are fictional, then why would it be recorded outside of the New Testament? It also can't explain why New Testament writers endured persecution, torture, and death. Why would they have done that for a fictional story? Third, historical novelists usually do not use the names of real people for the main characters in their stories, because if they did, those people, especially powerful government and religious officials, would deny the story, destroy the credibility of the author, and even take punitive damage against them for doing so. And as we've seen, the New Testament includes 30 actual historical figures confirmed by non-Christian sources, and many of these are prominent and powerful leaders. Finally, the New Testament contains multiple independent accounts of these events from 9 different authors. The historical novel theory would require a grand conspiracy over a 20 to 50 year period between those 9 authors spread all over the ancient world, which is not plausible. In fact, the assertion that the New Testament events are part of a grand conspiracy exists in novels. The real world, such assertions are crushed by the weight of the evidence. So yeah, there we go. All right, anybody have any thoughts, questions, anything on that? I'm trying to move fast today because I'm trying to wrap up by next week. So I'm just kind of hitting the highlights of this stuff. If you really want the details, again, get this book or a similar book. Go in there and look it up. It's definitely there. But so does anybody have any comments, thoughts so far? Yeah. So we're going to talk about the top 10 reasons that we know that New Testament writers told the truth. 1, they included embarrassing details about themselves. So one of the ways historians can tell whether an author is telling the truth is to test what he says by the principle of embarrassment. This principle assumes that any details embarrassing to the author are probably true. Why? Because the tendency of most authors is to leave out anything that looks bad. So how does the New Testament measure up to the principle of embarrassment? All right, so here we go. The people who wrote down much of the New Testament are characters in the story, often depict themselves as complete morons. So, one, they're dim-witted. Numerous times they fail to understand what Jesus is saying, and it gives a bunch of references here. They're uncaring. They fall asleep on Jesus twice when he asks them to pray. Later, believe that Jesus is the God-man, yet they admit they twice fell asleep on him in his hour of greatest need. They make no effort to give their friend a proper burial, but record that Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin, the very court that sentenced Jesus to die. They're rebuked. Peter is called Satan by Jesus, and Paul rebukes Peter for being wrong about a theological issue. They are cowards. All the disciples but one hide when Jesus goes to the cross. Peter even denies him 3 times after explicitly promising, "I will never disown you." Meanwhile, as the men are hiding for fear of the Jews, the brave women stand by Jesus and are the first to discover the empty tomb. They are doubters. Despite being taught several times Jesus would rise from the dead, there's a bunch of references there, the disciples are doubtful when they hear of his resurrection. Some are even doubtful after they see he was risen. So think about this. If you're a New Testament writer and you're making up a story, would you put all of that in there about yourself? Probably not, right? Okay. 2, the New Testament writers included embarrassing details and difficult sayings of Jesus. See, because they were also honest about Jesus, so they record embarrassing details about their leader that seemed to place him in a bad light. Let me explain. So in Mark, Jesus is considered out of his mind by his brothers and by his mother and brothers, his own family, who come to seize him in order to take him home. He's not believed by his own brothers. He is thought to be a deceiver. He is deserted by many of his followers. He turns off Jews who had believed in him to the point that they want to stone him. He's called a drunkard, he's called demon-possessed, he's called a madman, had his hair wiped with the feet of a prostitute, an event that had the potential to be perceived as a sexual advance, and he is crucified by the Jews and Romans despite the fact that anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. Okay, so those could be considered embarrassing details, right? If you're making up a story about God and about the deity of Jesus Christ, are you going to put all of that in that and give any type of leeway for people to say, oh, well, he's not who he says he is, right? So then you've got difficult sayings. So Jesus says, the Father is greater than I. He seems to predict incorrectly he's coming back to earth within a generation. Then he says about his second coming, no one knows the time, not the angels in heaven nor the Son. Seems to deny his deity by asking the rich young ruler, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. Is seen cursing a fig tree for not having figs when it wasn't even the season for figs. And he seems unable to do miracles in his hometown except to heal a few sick people. Now again, all of these say seems. You have to read, pay attention, use context. But these are things that are complicated statements and complicated additions to the story that, again, if you're making it up, you're not going to put it in there, right? The New Testament writers left in demeaning sayings of Jesus, or demanding sayings of Jesus. If they were making up a story, they would probably make up a story that would make life easier for them. Jesus had some very demanding standards. In the Sermon on the Mount, for example, it says, I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. I tell you, anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress. Anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, but in heaven. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. All these commands are difficult or impossible for human beings to keep and seem to go against the natural best interests of the men who wrote them down. They're certainly contrary to the desires of many today who want a religion of spirituality with no moral demands. Consider how extreme these things are. If thinking about a sin is sinful, then everyone is guilty. To set such stringent standards for divorce and remarriage doesn't appear to be in the earthly best interest of the men who recorded this. To not resist the insults of an evil person is to resist our basic human instincts. To pray for our enemies goes well beyond any ethic ever uttered. To not accumulate financial wealth contradicts our deepest desires for temporal security. To be perfect is unattainable for fallible human beings. And to not judge unless our own lives are in order counters our natural tendency to point out the faults in others. Why would they impose these standards on themselves? And who could impose these standards? Well, only somebody perfect, Jesus, right? The New Testament writers, number four, carefully distinguished Jesus' words from their own. Even though quotations mark didn't exist in first century Greek, they distinguished Jesus' words very carefully. Most red letter editions of the Bible are identical, illustrating how easy the New Testament writers made it to see what Jesus said and what he didn't say. Why do we cite this as evidence of trustworthiness? Because it would have been very easy for them to solve first century theological disputes by putting words into Jesus' mouth. So in other words, they could have resolved many conflicts or contradictions or whatever by just writing whatever they wanted to write and just said, Jesus said this, right? But that's not what they did. All right, number five, the New Testament writers include events related to the resurrection that they would not have invented, such as the burial of Jesus. See, Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish council that sentenced Jesus to die for blasphemy. Why would they have made that up? Considering especially the bitterness that some Christians harbored against Jewish authorities, why would they put a member of the Sanhedrin in such positive light? And why would they put Jesus in a tomb of Jewish authority? Because if Joseph didn't really bury Jesus, the story would have been easily exposed as fraudulent by the Jewish enemies of Christianity. But they never denied the story. The first witnesses. All four Gospels say women were the first witnesses of the empty tomb and first to learn about the resurrection. One of these was Mary Magdalene, who Luke admits had been demon-possessed. Why would they make it up? Not only would a once demon-possessed person be a questionable witness, but back then, women in general were not considered reliable witnesses. In fact, women's testimony carried no weight in a court of law. So if you're making up a resurrection story, you're definitely not going to have women as your main references and witnesses. The conversion of priests. So why didn't the risen Jesus appear to the Pharisees is a common question people ask. Well, probably because it wasn't necessary. In Luke, he writes, the number of disciples in Jerusalem increased rapidly, and a large number of priests became obedient to the faith. And so Why? Okay, and so then it tells a story during a council meeting between Peter, Paul, James, and other elders. Some of the believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees stood up and said the Gentiles must be circumcised and required to obey the law of Moses. The council resolved the issue, but the main point here is that Luke would not have included these details if they were fiction. Why? Because everyone would have known if the priest had converted or not. So you put that in the story, everybody knows. So it either happened or it didn't happen. And if it didn't happen, it creates a conflict there, right? But they never deny that it happened. Okay, and then the explanation of the Jews. So the Jewish explanation for the empty tomb is recorded in the last chapter of Matthew. It says, while the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city, reported the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So the soldiers took the money, did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. So notice Matthew makes it clear his readers already know about this explanation because the story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day, which means Matthew's readers and the Jews themselves would know whether or not he was telling the truth. Because if he was making up the story, why would he give his readers such an easy way to expose his lies? Either the story had circulated or it hadn't, right? Number six, the New Testament writers include more than 30 historically confirmed figures in their writings. We already talked about that. Seven, the New Testament writers include divergent details. So divergent details means, so for example, you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? And they all tell the gospel and they all tell their stories. But none of them tell a story the exact same way. They all tell it from a different point of view with different details, none of which are contradictory, by the way. They're complementary, okay? And so, again, you wouldn't have those different viewpoints if they got together and concocted a story, right? You ever seen, like, on a TV show, maybe somebody gets arrested or investigated or whatever, and they're like, oh, we got to get our story straight. And then they interrogate them, and they both say the exact same thing. And the interrogator's like, okay, if they're both saying the exact same thing, they made this up, right? Does that make sense? Because when two people tell a story, they might be very similar, but they're never going to be exactly the same. Does that make sense? All right. And then number eight, they challenge their readers to check out verifiable facts, even facts about miracles. So let's see. Luke's overall assertion to accuracy to Theophilus, Peter's claim that he did not follow cleverly devised tales but were eyewitnesses to Christ's majesty, Paul's bold declaration to Festus and King Agrippa about the resurrected Christ, Paul's restatement of an early creed identified more than 500 eyewitnesses of the risen Christ. Paul makes another claim in Corinthians that he wouldn't have made unless he was telling the truth. He declares that he previously performed miracles for them. Speaking of his own qualifications, someone who speaks for God, Paul reminds the Corinthians the things that mark an apostle, signs, wonders, and miracles were done among you with great perseverance. Now, why would he write that to the Corinthians unless he actually had really done miracles for them? So if he wrote to the Corinthians and says, hey, remember the miracles that I have done for you in the past, and they would go, wait, you didn't do any miracles. You have no credibility here. Obviously, he was telling the truth. Number nine, New Testament writers describe miracles with simple, unembellished accounts. Okay, so it gives an example here of a extremely dramatic story about Jesus' resurrection. It's not true. But the point is that if you are making this up and you are doing it for entertainment, for fiction, and this is the pivotal moment of the entire story, Jesus being resurrected, would you not make it the grandest, most just out there story, right? Because this is the climax of this book, right? Well, most of the accounts of this are very, very basic and simple. Mark describes the women saw this way. They looked up, they saw the stone, very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Don't be alarmed, he said. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. So that's just one example. I could go through the other examples, but the point is, none of these, like, glorify or expound or you know, does that make sense? Like, I mean, it's going to be like, if you're telling the story, it's going to be like, all right, so there was, you know, these angels came down, and man, they knocked the guards out, and then they pulled the stone away, and Jesus stands up, and he's like, hey, I'm risen, and he comes out, and the light's shining everywhere. You know, like, I mean, you're going to make it this fantastical, triumphant, overcoming, you know, story. They didn't do that because they were telling the truth, right? They almost downplay it. Does that make sense? You guys see that? All right. So, number 10, the New Testament writers abandoned their long-held sacred beliefs and practices, adopted new ones, and did not deny their testimony under persecution or threat of death. So, now, there are people that will say, well, you know, there are people that die for stuff all the time, right? So, you have specifically Muslims in Islam, right? So, you know, you have suicide bombers and things like that, and they believe. Now they truly believe what they're doing is real. But you have to understand, this goes back to these guys claim to be eyewitnesses. So in other words, you talk about the people today that believe things, believe in a cause and do things because of what they believe in, because of what they've been told, what they've been indoctrinated with. But these guys were the ones doing the telling and the indoctrination. So in other words, if they knew that they weren't eyewitnesses to these things, if they knew that their story was fake, they wouldn't have believed it, they sure as heck wouldn't have been martyred for it. Does that make sense? And so it's a very, very big difference. And so all of those reasons, all of those things are reasons that we can look at the credibility of what they wrote in the New Testament and how accurate it is. Does that make sense? Okay, so we're going to try to wrap this up next. Well, I say try. I mean, next week's my last week. So I'm going to do my best to wrap this up. Again, I'm really giving you guys a 1,000-foot view here. There's so much detail and so many good things in this book. If you guys get it, you can read it. You can see it for yourself. But so we're going to wrap this up next week and with basically focusing on, okay, so we know there's a God. Bible, we have enough evidence, probably true, okay? So, who's Jesus, right? So, we've talked about the resurrection. We've talked about the things he's done. So, is Jesus God or is he not? So, we're going to talk about that next week. And that's it. That's all I have. So.